If you want to get your favorite technical news, give Gizmo-Gang a call.
Gizmo-Sapien. Hey, and welcome to Gizmo-Sapien Show 130. We're titling this one, Winter is Just Another Step in the Cycle of Life. Well, it's actually part of a line from Groundhog Day, which I know happened in February, but the groundhog was wrong.
He's been arrested for fraud.
Exactly. He's on trial with Paul Manafort right now. Except he's looking at a much longer sentence.
Indeed.
Matt, I'm Chris, and with me today is Matt.
Hello.
And we're in I would like to use another piece of dialogue from the movie. We're in a Starbucks recording our episode today, which is a wretched hive of scum and villainy. it's a nice wretched hive of scum and villainy.
It's a little louder in here than our usual venue.
Yeah, the concrete floors, I think, make it a little more reflective. But Matt and I are going to talk about three things today that I think are immensely important to things going on. And I wish Dr. Sean was here, but I think I pissed him off the last time we...
they don't know that.
Well, I'm letting something going on because this is actually our second take at Show 130, because we're now going to make Show 130 something else, a later show, like 131, 132, so that we can have... It will still be probably an emotionally charged episode, but it will be an emotionally charged episode that has a lot more facts behind it, not supposition. which is... Hence why I think Dr. Sean is a little pissed at me.
He'll get over it.
He will. But that being said, the first thing I want to talk about is I think an incredible win for the United States and the American space program is the successful docking of the Dragon crew module with the International Space Station. So those of you who haven't been following along or listening to our previous podcast where we've talked a lot about SpaceX and Boeing and United Launch Alliance and all their plans on replacing the space shuttle with a new manned vehicle. It seems that SpaceX is by far out of the gates ahead of everybody at this point. They had been successfully, they've been the reusable rocket portion and they're landing them, but the next big step, and there is a Dragon cargo module that the crew module is based off of, that they've been using to resupply the International Space Station. So part of our tensions with Russia, actually, behind the scenes, is that they're not making as much revenue. The Roscosmos is not making as much revenue for the Russian government because they're the private space corporation that is the Russian space program. Because they're no longer handling all cargo and crew launches up to the ISS. And frankly, part of it needed to end because there have been quite a few launch problems with Roscosmos as of late. There's the sabotage of the module, which they say couldn't have been done from space, that was attached to the... that caused a environmental leak in the ISS. And then they also had a cargo module or cargo explosion. It didn't even make it to space. It blew up in the atmosphere. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. But you know, the other thing is SpaceX has also driven down the cost of putting men and material into space so much that NASA is actually being able to launch many, many, many more spacebound missions, whether they're satellites or putting people on the International Space Station or keeping them fueled. And you know, and SpaceX has some goals too. They want to go to Mars. They want to go and to the moon again and establish a moon base, if you will, Space 1999. Except it's Space 2019. We don't have Martin Landau anymore, but.
somehow we'll manage.
Yeah. But the fact that they have got the crew module up, they've done their test, it was considered a success. They landed the rocket back on the floating platform on the ocean. So the next step, which should happen in the next 30 days, is they're going to launch the test pilots up to the International Space Station in the Dragon crew module. And I think that's phenomenal, because Boeing, who is the other contender on that contract right now, and Boeing and United Launch Alliance are working together on their part, they haven't even launched their crew module by itself. And I think they're 3 or 4 months away from that test, and SpaceX will have already put people in the space. And, you know, I know it's not in the 1960s when the space race was going on, and this was something that was in the minds of every American and everybody in the world. But I think it's just as exciting, probably more exciting, because we're pushing the boundaries of what we've been doing in space a lot farther than we have in the past, since the 60s.
I think what makes it more interesting, I don't know about exciting, but more interesting at least, for those of us on the sideline watching this develop, is the fact that it's citizen run and driven, as opposed to government run.
Correct.
Government driven. I mean, even the Boeing stuff is more citizen driven now than what it was before.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, even the test pilots, they're not
military pilots, I mean.
Correct. Well, it's a combination of NASA astronauts and this SpaceX, because there's two teams. There's a group of NASA astronauts working with SpaceX, and there's a group of astronauts working with the Boeing ULA group, which the head of the Boeing ULA group pilot is an ex-astronaut. But the folks at SpaceX, which I find interesting, they're not, you know, they're not people who have gone through extensive NASA training. They have gone through extensive training, but you know, they weren't brought up, and they weren't ex-NASA people before becoming SpaceX people, is what I'm trying to say.
Which is both good and bad. I mean, they are having to essentially reinvent the wheel.
Well,
I think they're doing it in a way that's at least innovative. I mean, it's not that they're not learned, or they're just not experienced.
Yeah.
Which I think is...
Well, and you know, if you look at it at the same time, Larry Ellison's space company has also launched their space plane with 3 pilots and the first female pilot, which was exciting too in the last few weeks. Now, it's a little different. The space plane's never going to make the International Space Station. It goes into the upper atmosphere of the Earth, but they're still within the gravity well and everything else. But that being said, commercial spaceflight, and this is why I think it's exciting, because in the 60s, all the spaceflight, even though Boeing and Northrop Grumman and all the Beltway Bandits were involved in the construction and design and even the launching and everything, that was a government-driven program to develop a space-based transportation system that could have gone many ways. It did go many ways, because ballistic missiles came out of it out of that development. But what makes it exciting is in this respect is we're now getting commercial space flight. So in the case of Larry Ellison's company, he's taking civilians up who want to experience as close to space as they can get. And they do have to go through training, and as of right now, it's very expensive. SpaceX is looking at it from another point. If they get can help establish a base on the moon, then that means that we can, you know, they're funding private scientific research. That has the potential.
But again, the whole point behind building a base on the moon is is about colonizing Mars.
Yes.
So again, what you're seeing SpaceX do is essentially spending the half a mil on the on the paper plant,
yeah,
instead of spending the $1 trillion buying the big paper company.
Yes, you're right.
Just to make sure that it works as a test bed.
Exactly, but the potential for that test bed, it is very smart, but it also, the potential for what they can do with it is greater too, because they know that if they establish a new base, the next step after establishing is to make sure that it can be sustainable over a long period of time. You know, so in doing that, you'll be taking, you know, men and material up there. The potential for doing light gravity, or it won't be zero gravity. Well, it could be some zero gravity, but light gravity scientific experimentation. We already know that pharmaceutical companies are interested in that because they know that they can more efficiently make certain kinds of chemical reactions happen in low gravity environments and zero G environments. You know, so the other part of it is NASA gets to be part of it as opposed to have to drive it. So they're going to end up, and so will the U.S. Space Force, which is now part of the Air Force, which is, I disagree with, not so much in having a Space Force, but having it be part of the Air Force is kind of stupid to me. But the Air Force kind of needs a mission.
Till they dig up the Stargate and Giza Plateau.
Stargate Command. Yeah, I prefer the Star Trek way of doing it, where it's a naval tradition as opposed to a...
Agreed.
And, but that being said, it's an incredible achievement. You know, and the other thing is the alliance around the International Space Station, while I don't think it will completely fall apart, I think it is changing because of issues that Russia has just maintaining what Roscosmos can do, because an interesting article that I read about Roscosmos, and this is why I think there's it's being underreported, but there's a lot of attention from the Russian government on this, is they U.S. was their primary customer. They were making like 80% of their operating budget off of the United States. The problem is they didn't reinvest into it. So the Soyuz rocket that they're running is the same Soyuz rocket that they've been running for almost 40 years. And that technology is close to being at the end of its rope, you know, and it's expensive now compared to Boeing and SpaceX and what they can do. And so not only, you know, the Russians are mad at the U.S. government because they're not gaining that revenue to run their business, essentially, but they're also mad at the U.S. in general because it's U.S. companies which are leading a lot of this space exploration. And they're also mad at China for the same reason, because China has kind of gone off on their own and said, look, we can't afford to do this. So, you know, we're going in. And what's funny about it is it's almost like what was predicted in Firefly, that the two superpowers will end up being the United States and China as we move out into space.
Well, I think it's clear that the Russians can't afford to innovate. What makes their program is that it's mostly reliable.
Yes.
I mean, it's proven technology.
It is.
Do they have accidents? Sure.
But, you know, they've also put, how many rockets have they put into space?
Yeah.
And, you know, so you know you're going to have an attrition level grow the more launches you have.
Yes.
I mean, and we know that that's very true because look at SpaceX.
But part two of that is, I don't understand why the Russians are upset. They got this business because we stopped sending up the space shuttle, and we were never going to permanently let the Russians be our way to space.
Well, but the problem is, so what happened, in essence, was it's not just the U.S. men and material being launched out of the Roscosmos facilities, but they're also losing the sale of the Soyuz engines that ULA and all these other companies were buying to put rockets in space here in the United States. And, you know, so now the pretty much the only people who are buying engines from them are India.
I'm a creative destruction kind of guy. If the Russians wanted to stay in this business,
they would have innovated. No, I absolutely, totally agree with you. I'm not not opposing it. I'm just saying that I think it's something that's totally underreported as we, you know, at these things, you know, as why are tensions getting worse, you know? And a lot of it is always economic, you know? And you take that and you also take in the fact that European countries aren't bringing in all the Russian natural gas and fuel line. You know, who are their biggest customer because of other issues? And, you know, Russia's, you know, every book I've ever read on history, they talk about the Russian people as being, of all the Europeans, talking about being, because they had been isolated for so long, that they don't think like the rest of the Europeans. And I am talking, you know, Russia proper, the Caucasus, you know,
area. I totally get it.
And I think that's why we're hearing things like, you know, we have the super nuclear torpedo and all this other stuff. Because I think it's their way of culturally
trying to reclaim relevance.
Correct. Well, I think that we kind of talked about that more. I can't wait to see the crew launch. I think that'll be really exciting again. And
it will be fun to finally see an American launch with American personnel on an American rocket.
Yeah, you got it.
I love the international cooperation, but I'm an American.
Absolutely.
American.
So the next one is also very relevant to technology and American politics, and that is Senator Elizabeth Warren has come out and stated that she wants to break up companies like Amazon, Facebook, and I just look at that and I you know, it's a facepalm. When has the government ever been good at breaking up companies? So let's go back to the 80s when we broke up AT&T and we created all the baby bells. And then in the 90s and early 21st century, we let AT&T buy all the baby bells back up and become AT&T again. And the funny thing about that is they artificially split the company up, and you had these baby bells like Southwestern Bell, who serviced this area, SBC, and you had Quest out west and all this stuff, and they were able to operate for a while, but they in turn, during their 20 or so years of operating, started buying up other smaller communications companies. So we had a consolidation, and then they were still small enough that they could be consolidated because there needed to be a contraction in the market for all this, and there's still competition. But the other thing is telephone is a meaningless market anymore. I don't know, most people, one, don't have or don't use a standard POTS line anymore. Their telephone, if they have a telephone in their house, it's delivered via their cable provider, who also, you know, that is part of the bundle. And when I did bundle with my cable provider, they were giving me the phone free because I kept telling them I don't want it, and I never had it hooked up in my house, because when I did, the phone numbers that I was getting, it was always for somebody. I would get calls at all times of the day for people looking for somebody, and I even complained, and they were like, we'll do our best and all this, and they're like, you know, you can go online and block these calls, and I'm like,
why is that my responsibility?
Why is that my problem? And so I just unplugged it. And, you know, eventually I I cut the cord, and the only thing I have from my cable company anymore is internet, because they're the most competitive rate with reliable, relatively reliable service for my internet. But if they weren't, you know, I would go to somebody else for that, like AT&T.
But here's the problem. Anytime the government gets involved in stuff like that, there isn't real competition.
No, it's artificial competition. Because now what you're doing is you're taking a company that is successful, and they who already has competition today, and you're breaking them up, and you're trying to make them compete against each other. So what do? They buy the guys who were their competition out so that they can get bigger to compete against each other. And then eventually,
yes.
And we also know that if you artificially break it up, somebody else is going to come along with it. And I hate to use this term anymore because it has become so cliche. They're going to disrupt that market. That's what Amazon did. They disrupted the market. It's not that all these companies are going away. In my opinion, the closing of Sears and all the bookstores like Borders and all that everybody blames on Amazon is, look, they were being run wrong. They weren't delivering the goods and services the way consumers wanted them. And so that's what capitalism is. They you know, they didn't succeed, so they went bankrupt and they're now out of the market.
Creative destruction.
Yes. And so I don't see, you know, the sad part of it is there's two things that I see that go on as I get older, is everybody knows that change is inevitable. It's going to happen. We're going to have change. But everybody seems to be afraid of that change. Or I won't say everybody, but a good majority of people are afraid of that change. And a lot of those people are the people who, because they can't adapt or they're not willing to adapt to that change, they want it to happen the other way. Now, so that's the other problem, that artificially breaking the company up. It does not change that the market has changed from a business perspective. Look at cell phones versus, the reason nobody uses POTS lines anymore is because cell phones, one, have become very reliable. Two, everybody has a cell phone today. Whether you have a flip phone to a smartphone, everybody's got a phone, if not more than one. And three, people don't communicate via voice a lot anymore. I mean, if I don't recognize a phone number, and this is not me, you can find articles in the Washington Post, New York Times, Popular Mechanics. They talk about there's so much spam calls that the telephone has gone the way of fax machines. You know, remember when you had a fax machine in your office and you come in every morning and there'd be all kinds of spam because some telemarketer figured out that this was your fax line, or you published your fax line online or on your business card, and so they would then add it to their list of, you know, send telemarketing. And so what happened? Well, when something better than fax machines came along, we got rid of fax. When some things became better than email, like encrypted texting, people now text. Why? Because it's easier to either block, it's easier to delete, it's easier to, you know, get rid of this. You know, junk mail was, I mean, before you had junk mail filters that would learn what was junk and wasn't junk, email sucked. You know, you go in, and I remember going into I worked for the government, so this was my government email account. I remember going in the morning and having 200 or 300 emails, and only 3 or 4 of them being relevant to work I was doing. You know, and through the day. And then luckily, junk filters, now I don't see, I mean, I still see some junk, but I don't see nearly as much as I did. And why? Well, the market had to change because people weren't going to use that as a relevant communication device anymore. And that's what happened. And you know, to stick to these, I think the other thing that cell phone providers did too is they brought choice. I mean, we've seen a lot of consolidation in that industry, but I at least have three other choices than the vendor I have.
That's the point that I was going to make about cable. Based on what happened to the landline market, there is no real choice because it's all regional.
Yes.
And they bought up, and I understand why they do it. It's expensive for every company to come and
bury lines
everywhere and all of that, which is why I fully support whatever wireless cable we can get. But my point stands. There's no real competition there. It's all supportive of a monopoly. And even with government intervention, they just paid it lip service.
Electric's the same way.
Yes, exactly. And that's even worse because not only do you have a federal layer of nonsense,
you have a state layer
of nonsense.
Yep. Yeah, and the illusion of choice, particularly in the electric industry, is completely fraudulent. And you know, there's also local and county layers of nonsense with electric too, or power generation. You know, we talk about energy independence in the United States, but they mean for the power companies. They don't mean for the individual, which, by the way, what does the Constitution say? It's a government of the people, by the people, for the people. Not of the corporation, by the corporation, for the corporation. Although it's slowly becoming that. Well, it's not slowly. It has become.
Or by the government.
For the government.
For the government. We've allowed some things.
Absolutely.
I joke about this a lot, but our founding fathers fathered some founding over a 3% tea tax.
Yes.
We've allowed ourselves to be taxed into oblivion. Our founding fathers would be
furious.
Mightily.
Yeah.
But we've allowed it to continue.
Yes. And by we mean the royal we. And stuff. I totally agree. And the sad part is, is that again? There's a fear of change, and it was interesting. So, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts besides hosting podcasts, partly because I've probably been doing this, I can't remember how long I've been doing this, but it's been over 5 years. It's probably been close to 10 at this point. But I go back and sometimes I listen to some of my first podcasts and I realize how stilted the language was and the fact that I was afraid to let a pregnant pause happen. But one of the podcasts I've been enjoying lately, and I certainly don't agree with all his politics, but you know, that's another thing is you cannot be afraid to listen to the other side to form your opinion. If your beliefs are strong, then you're not going to flip-flop. But Alan Alda has a phenomenal podcast, and he runs I'm not sure if they're a nonprofit. I think they're a nonprofit, but runs and they're dedicated to the science of communication. And part of the reason I listen to it is because he gets authors and a lot of people, and they talk about how to communicate. And he made a comment in his last podcast about, you know, that young people and why we see people like AOC do so well is because they're explosive, but they want to burn everything down. They don't have the long experience to go back and look at and go, okay, that may not be the best way to go about it. And I think that because of that attitude, and it's not just the United States, this is worldwide, you see it happen in populations. So look at France and what's going on there. But they forced the government to make these, to legislate everything by a knee-jerk. And so not only are, I mean, I believe we're over-legislated in the United States, but we're not even close to, like in some places in the world. Excuse me. And but I would say 90% of legislation is not well thought through for a couple of reasons, but one of them is because a lot of it's reactionary. As opposed to taking a step back and going, well, maybe we shouldn't do anything about this yet. Because one incident happened does not mean we have a problem. You know? And I mean, there's other issues too. There's denial. There's the fact that we legislate because of it's politically beneficial. You know? It's going to help me get reelected. And most of politicians worldwide and elected governments, they spend 80% of their time in office working on getting reelected. And the only time that they actually do real government work, you know, for the people is when they can't be reelected again. And I find that sad.
And the number of politicians that are in that situation puts them in a minority of a minority.
Exactly. Exactly.
So they're not really getting anything done anyway.
No. No. But that being said, how would you break... It doesn't make sense on how you would break Amazon up anyway. You know, you can spin AWS off as its own company and then spin the retail part, you know, as its own company. What does that do? Because one, it's two separate markets that Amazon doesn't compete against itself in. And then, you know, why do you want to split up Facebook? You know,
into what?
Yeah, exactly. And as a matter of fact, you know, social media platforms are always evolving, and Facebook is on the downturn. You know, the stuff that Mark Zuckerberg is trying to do is keep his company relevant. But, you know, Facebook is going to eventually, it's not going to be as spectacular like when MySpace died, but where's MySpace today? Where's The Well, the first social network ever? They don't exist. I mean, think about it. So, you and I, growing up in the early days of computers, used to be part of the Dayton Freenet. And why was the Dayton Freenet important to us? It was a social network. It provided us free email. It allowed us to chat with each other online in real time, or close to real time. You know?
Plus, it was a community.
It was a community. And where is it today? It's a memory.
I'm not sure they're still operating or not. They operate much longer than was totally necessary.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Because the community
bought
and supported it.
Yeah. I don't believe they're still around. If they are...
They may have shut down by now, but I know they were running much longer than was absolutely necessary.
But, you know, so, at some point, Facebook is going to hit the point where decline is a big issue. And they are doing some things smart. Facebook is becoming more of a competitor to Craigslist. You know, and frankly, what does Facebook really make their money and revenue on? Advertising, just like Google. So, split them up and what's going to happen? You know, you going to make them sell off Instagram or Snapchat? Or what is the one they own? They own Instagram.
They bought WhatsApp. They bought one of the messengers. I forget which one.
Well, WhatsApp was kind of a messenger.
Well, WhatsApp was on the decline when they bought them. They bought them for their IP. I think they own Instagram, too.
Video calls got much better after Facebook bought WhatsApp.
Yeah.
Yeah, I buy that.
And, you know, and I look at that and it's, you know, what's it going to do? And you know, you have to look at other companies, too, which they've already tried. They tried to split up Microsoft, and we knew that was going to be a failure. On multiple reasons. One, the government is one of Microsoft's biggest customers, so you're going to bite the hand that that feeds you.
No, well, again, for me, this comes down to government trying to pick winners and losers. And
what's government overstepping?
There's just overreach is the word you're looking for there, and I don't think the government's ever been good at that.
No.
Why start now? Why try it again now? There's no history of that being a successful
model.
You can break up monopolies and generate genuine competition. Government hadn't done that
since the railroads. Even then, it wasn't long before the railroads were supplanted by automobiles. Yeah. Actually, it goes a long way to say that, you know, it's picking and choosing, you know. The reality of it is General Motors should have been...
The only remotely possible positive outcome of breaking up big tech is causing creative destruction that
True.
Would lead to disruptive technologies that would take over.
But I don't think that...
I don't think that's the situation.
I don't think that's the situation, and I don't think it would happen in that case. Because you look at their businesses and what they do, you know... Because Google's on the hit list too, you know, and Google is a subsidiary of Alphabet. They're not even a company, you know, their own company anymore. And the other issue that's part of this too is that, you know, the people behind this, they're professional politicians. They haven't done an honest lick of work in their life. They don't know business. They don't know the markets that they're in. They just have this perception like they're all knowing and how this works. And so they don't have a concept of, okay, how would we... Yeah, it's a great idea, but how do we execute? And,
We deem it as such. And that's how it works in government.
Yeah.
That's how it works in politics. The real world, it don't work that way.
No.
Never has.
And I guarantee you, before they could even break it up, that these companies all have plans in place. Because, you know, Alphabet owns 100 companies. And they're not all successful. And so they would just start dumping things and go, well, what are you talking about? We've sold off all these... You know, we can't be a monopoly in this space because we don't own all this stuff. And then the things that are profitable for them, they would not change a lick. You know, there's only about 5 or 6 products.
And what's bad about that is, even if these companies were evil, they'd get away with it because they bought the politicians too.
Correct. Correct.
It's an entirely corrupt system. But it's the best one we got.
Yeah. Yeah, worldwide it is. It is. So, on the final thing, and you and I laugh about this, and actually this is something my son and I have talked about a lot, because he was on the other side of this, and I'm like, you know, you gotta let competition and things happen and it will all work out into what the market demands, and that's net neutrality, because now we have this new house bill to bring net neutrality rules back. And I sit there and I go, okay, So has my service gotten worse? Can I not get to Netflix or Hulu or whoever since the net neutrality rules, you know, which was the fear that, you know, Verizon has their own, or AT&T owns DirecTV, which has their own streaming service, and so they were going to limit Netflix. And guess what happened? Nothing. You know? And I am not a fan of our current FCC chairman, because I think he's a Ajit Pai is a shill for for big business.
Okay.
He was a lawyer for Verizon, which, although I like Verizon as a company, and they've actually been my customer in the past, and I am a customer of theirs, I'm not... I don't like this guy's politics. There's just been some of the stuff he has made policy around, I don't totally agree with. And luckily, a lot of it has been meaningless anyway, because the market demand changed the thing he made policy around, so his policy was useless. But, you know, one of the things I don't like, and particularly in today's day, I can understand bandwidth management, so, you know, and, you know, that companies who want dedicated bandwidth, meaning, you know, frequency ranges that they can use for their products. So, like, the cell phone companies, they own bands of frequency so that their cell phone work in there. I'm okay with that. What I'm not okay with is, so we have set aside the ham radio bands and we have the citizen radio bands. Those bands, I don't believe I should have to pay the FCC a license to operate in the ham radio band. It limits innovation, because, and they have a lot of rules that I think are stupid. Like, because one of the things I've looked into and I've been studying for is to take my ham radio license, because I think it's interesting, plus the fact that there's a lot of really nice, cheap Chinese radios on the market that, you know, you can use in an emergency. But ham radio, to a large degree, has not changed since the 1920s, when they started putting all of this in place. And why has it changed? Well, the rules around ham radio, like, you have to, every so many minutes, if you're broadcasting, you have to give your call sign. Well, you know, so one of the things you can do on ham radio is packet radio transfer. So you can actually send data over the network to, you know, from one computer to another, or a series of computers. Well, if I have to do that, and every so many minutes transmit, I can write a computer program that will do that. But I can't implement things like TCP stacks over packet radio, because I then I'm creating latency in my network. Why is it important that I do that all the time? Because it's a huge radio frequency, but if people were allowed to do it, it would allow a lot more freedom in communication. And I think that's more important than the rules wrapped around it. It's about freedom and liberty. And we have the citizen radio bands, which actually aren't hardly used anymore. Nobody uses it. Trucks don't use CB radios. They use cell phones now. Because they're long distance, and they're a hell of a lot more reliable. You know? And I know why the FCC put those rules in place originally, but again, it was a knee-jerk reaction over something that I don't really think has been a problem over time.
I would have to look into this more.
Well, I know people who... We both have a friend in common who has been a ham radio operator for probably longer than we've both been alive. I was thinking about reaching out to him to get his take on this.
What I was going to say, though, is that I think the reason why you have annoyance regulations like that is to prevent communications companies from coming in buying up all that bandwidth.
That's the thing, is it? I think the frequency management piece of it makes sense. The government says that from this range to this range, you know, it's only for hobbyists or, you know, because one of the things that I do admire about the reason I wanted to get my ham radio license was because in emergencies, you know, when natural disasters happen and stuff, the ham radio, they, when you have a license, you actually become part of the National Emergency Disaster Communication System. You know, so you can, you know, communicate with, and I do understand that the voice protocols and stuff wrapped around that, but to get innovation in that, the regulations need to change. And the problem is with regulation is like tax. Once it's there, they never go away. They just add more to it. You know, look at how many ridiculous laws are on the books today in local governments and state governments and even the federal government that aren't even relevant. You know, but they're there. Like, you know, you can't have a pet alligator in Oklahoma or, you know, there's probably thousands of them. And nobody's bothered to repeal them. Why? Well, part of it is, it again, why? The chance of somebody in this day and age having something like that is rare. And when it is, most of the time it's just overlooked, you know? Now, some of them make sense, like the zoo animal law in Ohio, you know? But in Cincinnati, you can actually have pet tigers and lions and stuff.
But this is where I go back and say that, honestly, what needs to happen to government at all levels is a sunset review. Periodically, we need to go back to a blank page. And we don't do that in this country.
No.
I'd be happy to have, let's just reset to the Constitution and the 25, 26, 27 amendments that number is.
And the Bill of Rights, and you're done.
And let's just start over. Because quite frankly, we're controlled by pieces of legislation that nobody remembers except the black robe judiciary.
Well, and they don't remember it. They have to go search for something. And that's what happens is law then becomes something used in an antagonistic way, not for what it was intended for.
Yes.
You know, and the problem is not only would we have to periodically go through that and sunset that, but we'd have to do it at the state level too. You know, because each state has their own constitution. How many people know their own state's constitution? I couldn't tell you what ours says. I could tell you some of what it says, but that's only because I've looked up specific pieces. I couldn't tell you, not like the United States Constitution.
Plus, what makes more sense at the state level, or it doesn't necessarily make more sense, but what actually happens at the state level versus what happens at the federal level. We all know what the Constitution is supposed to be.
Yeah.
But we've got all these regulations.
Yeah.
At the state level, in our state in particular, the Constitution means less than Ohio Revised Code.
Yeah. But going back to the net neutrality thing, I think it's very similar to the let's split companies up. It's an artificial way of trying to pick how the market works instead of just letting the market work out. Because and this is creative destruction. So what if companies like AT&T decided that their customers, they were going to throttle Netflix, who's a force to be reckoned with at this point?
Their customers would leave.
Their customers will leave.
Assuming there is legitimate competition.
Or somebody new will come in and disrupt the market and have a new service that will allow them to get to Netflix. Again,
yeah.
Customers will leave because now there's more competition.
But again, this is government intervention and market manipulation to choose winners and losers, when again, government is not good at that.
Correct. You know the type of, and this is interesting, I think I've mentioned this before, where the government would do a good job picking winners and losers is I think I told you this story. I was flying out to California, and I got bumped, because of frequent flyer, I got bumped up to first class, and I sat next to this guy who also lived out in rural Ohio, and we got to talking, and come to find out, he was a policy advisor on healthcare, and he had worked in the Clinton administration, he had worked in the George W. Bush administration, and he currently was flying out to Australia because he worked for the Australian government, and he got to talking about, you know, inevitably we got to talking about government subsidized healthcare and everything, and he said the one thing that in socialized medicine that is probably worked out to be a good thing, or at least it has for companies like Australia and Great Britain and European countries, is that, and he said, because the U.S. doesn't do this, it's at a great disadvantage to U.S. citizens. Is that, you know, where they're negotiating with the drug companies for the cost, and because the government makes the order, and then the doctors get it from the government and dispense it, so they can have a stable cost on drugs, particularly new drugs, that U.S. citizens bear the piece of that, because everybody else is making our. If we would negotiate, you know, from that perspective, where the government is going to the companies and negotiating the drug prices that people would pay. Yes, it is market manipulation, but that's probably at least a more workable way of doing it than. Now, that being said,
that's treating medication like a public utility.
Correct, and
I have ethical concerns about
that. I do too, but that's the only time I think at least there's a snip of possibility that could happen. Because what it ends up being is the governments of the world who are doing the negotiation are the market, and whoever negotiates better gets the best deal. And the problem is we're just not negotiating well.
Yes and no. The problem with a lot of that is a PR problem.
It is.
If there's some new awesome drug that will address some affliction that's a global epidemic.
Yeah.
In a real world, this company that has developed this treatment will have the ability to sell it to whoever they want at whatever price. So if poor country A doesn't afford it, part of what we're doing
and here's where I am such a capitalist and believe in the way the markets work, because you can see it's something you see over time, and we can historically look back and go, okay, this market was, you know, they had competition. Well, I'll tell you, so something relevant to me, there's a book by a guy named Clayton Christensen, and the whole first three quarters of the book is about the hard disk drive market. And, you know, it used to be hard disk drives were like humongous things. And there were all these companies who sold the hard disk drive. And then as new technology came out, and they shrunk and shrunk and shrunk. And today, you can see a continuation of this, but at this time, he's talking about through the 60s, 70s, 80s, early 90s. And the book's called The Innovator's Dilemma. And all these companies went out of business because they couldn't change their markets to address the new technology that everybody was, you know. And some of the companies actually developed the new technology weren't successful because they tried to sell the new technology to their old customers who didn't need that technology, they need the old technology, you know. And so there was, you know, there was companies consolidating, you know, buying competitors who were going out of business or who and you know, and then there were winners. And then you'd see this group of guys when they got to the new technology, all these companies were competing there. And the same thing would happen to the new technology, and the same thing would happen to the new technology. And we don't see that in the drug industry until the patents run out. And the other problem is too, back in the 50s, thanks to Ayn Rand and her book Atlas Shrugged, there was a cultural shift in business on what was the main focus. And we're seeing a customer shift come, or a company shift come back, or a corporate culture shift come back from that because of data privacy concerns and things like that. And that's why we have people knee-jerk reaction saying that we need to break up Amazon, Facebook, and Google. You know, and Google used to say don't be evil, and that was part of that, was their, you know, it was their PR trying to overcome that. But you know, there was a shift, and you know, and it probably culminated in the 80s with, you know, things like how Wall Street was operating and how we viewed Wall Street. But it changed from companies being part of society, and you saw it through the, you saw things change. You saw like General Motors Corporation, who used to be known as Generous Motors, you know, that because the bottom line became more important than the employees that who were helping make the bottom line, you know, they started cutting all of these benefits and things. It's not like GM in the 80s did have a problem money-wise, but when they became profitable again, it's not like they started, you know, adding these things back, because they wanted to have as much profit as possible. And that's really what the cultural shift was from a, and we still are seeing a lot of that today, but you know, it used to be in the past, prior to that cultural shift, that companies would make a profit and they would also either give back to the community or they would give back, and not in a PR manner.
This is where I go back and say the reason why poor country A is able to get medication to deal with the epidemic is that because country B that's rich is subsidizing that through the price structure.
Yeah.
Is that fair? Probably not. But in a global health crisis, what's more important? Dealing with the epidemic or someone's concept of economic fairness? I don't know.
Well, you could take it to another perspective. Now, this is all hypothetical. I don't totally believe this. But you have a world health crisis, and you have a country who cannot afford economically to pay for some. The capitalist way is to say, well, tough luck.
Creative destruction.
Correct. Now, we know that doing things like that causes economic instability, it causes wars, it causes mass migrations, look at Syria. But you know, you have to, if you believe in those tenets, you should at least look at it from that perspective too. And that's what I'm saying about, you know, ethical capitalism versus...
Exactly. So then it becomes a matter of, well, at some point, what's going to happen is this company will produce and liquidate their product for less than fair market value and go under.
Yeah. Well, look at the company who, what was that cancer drug that company? I don't even remember the company's name now, but... Just recently, they announced a price hike on a drug that they've been selling for a fair and reasonable price, and you know they I think it was a 10x price increase, and within a year they were out of business.
I support innovation. I support doing the right thing. But at some point, somebody has to look at these companies and understand they have to make a profit. They're a company.
Yes.
And if they don't make a profit, they shut down. And what happens to those innovations? What happens in the world crisis? I don't know. This is where I say I'm a libertarian leaning conservative capitalist, but I believe in the importance of a safety net.
Yeah.
Somebody has to make this company whole.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to end it. So we want to hear from you, our listeners. So please send us some feedback, audio, video, text, however you want to do it, to gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. Or visit our website at www.gizmosapiens.com. And leave a feedback on our on this episode of the podcast, which is episode 130, and we'll see you on the digital flip side.
Gizmo Sapiens, a technology and entertainment podcast. You can reach us at our email address at gizmosapiens@gmail.com. That's gizmosapiens@gmail.com. We'd really love to hear from you, and we'll see you next week from the digital flip side.